Thank you, Jason, and thanks for inviting me to give this talk and also to this workshop. I definitely would not be here if it wasn't for Jason's encouragement and leadership. And let's see, it's late in the day here, and even later in Seattle. So hopefully this will be coherent. But my thought is to give a very concrete talk with concrete examples and challenges. In our workshop today, we've been talking about a lot of very abstract issues with very powerful machinery. So maybe this will be an antithesis. I'm going to start by talking about machine reading and my dark past very briefly, and then I'll switch over to talk about my present and future, which is the Allen Institute for AI, which we call AI2 for short. And I'll talk about lots of examples of problems that we're working on. I don't actually have a whole lot of solutions. What I really wanted to introduce is some concrete problems and some concrete data sets, as well as metrics and methodologies for addressing those. So I'll actually move quickly so we have time for questions at the end. Martha promised to heckle me, and I'll ask her to save that to the end. But if you have clarifying questions, please don't hesitate to ask. So, as Jason said, we started thinking about machine reading in 2006 under that heading. Other people were thinking about related ideas, of course, way before then. And this is a picture that I stole from a DARPA initiative that came later along these lines. And the approach we took to machine reading is to start with information extraction, or IE, which I take to be a function that maps a single sentence to a tuple and an associated confidence. So something like Edison, by all accounts, was the inventor of the light bulb, and we know from that Edison invented the light bulb, hopefully with high probability or high confidence. And typically, these sorts of techniques that have been studied extensively in NLP require pre-specified relations, hand-labeled training examples of each of these relations, right, positive and negative, as well, and then the use of lexicalized features that are specific to each of these relations or predicates, right? So if I want to know about invented, then I better think about people, about places, about inventions, et cetera, et cetera. And this is here's an example from Nell, which is the CMU project, which is one of the leading projects in trying to do this kind of thing from the web. And this is an example of what Nell knows about Obama. He's a politician. He's male. And then we can also get into relational facts, like he was born on a particular date and graduated from a particular university, et cetera, et cetera. And one nice thing is this is available on the web, so you can go and look at it, see in details both what it knows, what it doesn't know. It's very transparent, which is helpful. I dug a little bit more in, and to show you, here are some of the lexical patterns it has for the relation has wife. And we see the top patterns include things like a bad influence on, or a child through, abusive to. When I looked further, it seemed that Nell, this program, it's operating over web pages, and it seems to have developed kind of an unhealthy obsession with Angelina Jolie, which is explains some of these patterns. I don't necessarily think that's inherent to the paradigm, but I thought that was amusing. So there's a problem with this approach in terms of scalability. Think about if you pick up the newspaper in the morning, there isn't somebody looking over your shoulder saying, okay, I want you to study this particular relation, has wife or invented, and here, by the way, are some labeled training examples. It's much more of an open-ended exploratory process that might be more worthy of the name reading. We don't know in advance what we're going to see. And so back in 2007, we started thinking about open information extraction, where all these things are not pre-specified. We don't have hand label examples. We're not told in advance what's the set of concepts of relations we're going to focus on. And instead, we asked the question, can we leverage regularities in language to extract information in a much more general way? And we found that actually relations are often anchored in verbs. They often have a very simple syntactic form, so that we can actually do this with surprisingly good levels of recall and precision. And so what that means is that we don't need hand-labeled data, as I said. Actually, we didn't even use parsers initially, which was a good thing, because typically the parsers are trained on the Wall Street Journal corpus, and typically we were using arbitrary web text, which looks different than the Wall Street Journal corpus, and so parsers did not work very well. We also had this idea of which we called no sentence left behind, right? If I give you an arbitrary sentence in English, we just focused on English, but of course this generalizes to other languages. In fact, by now there have been open IE systems built for at least 4 languages, including Chinese. And so if I give you an arbitrary sentence, you want to be able to extract something from that. So that's another key thing. And in exchange for all these knows, right, no hand-labeled data, being able to work with arbitrary sentences, we did use redundancy and serendipity of the web to get information. Anyway, I'm not going to delve into the details here, except to say that we worked on it for something like 6 years or so, and had what we like to call happy curves, right? We continually increased the precision and yield. I don't want to say recall, but the amount of information that we were able to extract from these kinds of systems. And we still have a demo available on the web, it extracts various things. Here I give the example of Apple, you know, Obama. We can do Obama as well, but when you ask what does it know about apples, and this is the system having been run on the CLUWeb corpus, so that's approximately 10 billion sentences, and so it sees different kinds of apples, and if we choose apple the fruit, we can see that apples are tender, they grow on trees, they contain pectin, so we get a bunch of, they're high in dietary fiber, we get a bunch of useful information in a very scalable manner. At the same time, it's also very shallow. There's something very unsatisfying about this, particularly, I think, if you're any of the people that I spent the day with today. The semantics are weak. After a while, I grew dissatisfied with it too, and I asked, how can we go further? And here's a quote from Paul Allen. He said, in order to be truly intelligent, computers must understand, that is probably the critical word. It's one thing to feed A Tale of Two Cities into a computer. It's another thing to have the computer understand what's being said. What's impressive to me about that statement, which maybe took me until 2013 to conclude, was that he was saying that back in 1977. And I think that statement is still true today, that a lot of the NLP research is short on understanding. So we started this institute very recently, and the mission is to do AI research and engineering with an emphasis on these kinds of understanding problems. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk, as I said, a little bit more about the institute, and then we'll get into some specific NLP examples and data. I just wanted to mention we have a scientific advisory board that we're very proud of, from Adam Shire, who did Siri, to Tom Mitchell and Dan Roth, who think about aspects of NLP and machine learning. So we're not just relying on our own intelligence, but on our advisors. And what we do, we're a nonprofit research institute, and we both do experimental science projects, and we have a variety of research collaborations. This is just a sample of the folks that we've collaborated with and funded. And we're also very interested in open source initiatives. Again, as a nonprofit, we have the luxury of focusing on building things and focusing on giving back to the community. And just one example of that, this is something that we're hoping to launch in the next month or so. We've realized that there isn't, as far as I know, a clearinghouse of all the AI open source software and data that's available out there. And certainly there isn't the ability to discuss it and give key comments like, oh, this software I downloaded looked promising, but after a week of delving into it, I found it's actually pretty buggy, right? That could save you a week of time. Or if I want, I don't know, a CSP solver that handles soft constraints in C#, well, you know, here are the ones that are available and here's the differences between them. So we've been working to collate these, and we want to open this up to the community, kind of a searchable directory plus Quora for these resources. And this effort will only be successful if the community adopts it and starts to use it. So I wanted to mention this here as an infomercial. Hopefully when you hear about it being released, you'll check it out, you'll see what people are saying about your software, and you'll correct them at the very least. Okay, so what's the timeline of what I'm talking about? We're very young. AI2 was launched in January. In March, we launched a research program. Actually, I should be clear about this. The Paul Allen Foundation, which is a different body, launched an Allen Distinguished Investigator Award program. We've helped shape the topics there. And so you'll, if you're familiar with it, you'll see there are topics near and dear to our hearts around semantics, around diagram understanding, and a number of things. If you haven't heard about this program, don't worry. There should be another one in 2015 and more. And it's a really exciting program because it's meant to give large amounts of money to breakthrough research in a way that's unencumbered. So it's not NSF, which tends to be kind of conservative. It's not DARPA, which tends to be kind of militaristic. It's and not just militaristic, right? I could spend the whole talk talking about what's wrong with DARPA. And one thing that I was able to persuade the foundation of is it's completely international, so it's also not focused on Americans by any means. So hopefully you'll apply. We also have a summer intern program. We have about 10 interns, and we're starting to recruit for interns for next year. By the way, I said it's summer, but really we have interns year-round. We have somebody coming in the fall, and we have already our first intern from John Hopkins who's coming next summer, I believe. To put you on the spot. We're also expanding into areas like vision, so we have a workshop of some of the top people who think about vision and semantics. You know, vision, machine vision has kind of gravitated over the years into the direction of graphics and computational photography, photorealistic rendering. We're trying to reclaim that and ask, what is a research agenda in machine vision that ties to language or that ties to AI that would be of interest? And that would be also a topic for us in 2015. And lastly, as I mentioned, we're about 20 people at this point. We're aiming to grow to about 50 over the next year and a half. So we're hiring extensively. So again, if you're interested in that, just send me an email, or if you have a student graduating, or if you are a student graduating. I like to say that talent plus mission equals impact, and in one sentence, that's our model. We're trying to get the smartest people across a variety of disciplines. We're focused on a particular mission and trying to have an impact on the field. So let me get more concrete and tell you about our flagship project, and then show you a number of examples of that. So I spend personally a lot of time thinking about methodology. What is a methodology that's going to deliver results in a relatively short time frame? I'm an impatient person. When I see people engaged in activities that are kind of stretching over what seems to be like a 1,000-year time frame, or that haven't really changed in the last 20 years, I worry about that, right? If we were doing something 20 years ago, we're still doing it today, that's a bad sign, right? If we're doing something and our goals are so modest that if you just play it out to fruition, we're going to get there in 100 years or 1,000 years, maybe that's the reality. I'm not willing to accept that. I'm more impatient than that. I want to see significant breakthroughs in AI in a shorter time scale. So that's what's informing my thinking here. So here's what we do. We take externally defined challenge tasks. I'll give lots of examples in a second. We work on training data, and then we test ourselves on unseen test data as is. And that gives us two things. One is measurable progress, so we can avoid deluding ourselves as to whether we're making progress or not. The field of AI and NLP is replete with examples of people deluding themselves into thinking they were making progress. I hope that's not controversial, but if we can debate that after the talk if you like. Also gives us a clear focus. Very, very hard to tell what's the next problem, what's going to make a difference. Well, in our case, it's easier. It's an empirical question. If we have an approach and we think it's going to make a difference, we test it on our data and we can see. Now, these bullets are actually quite similar to the methodology that was used in Watson to help them in 3 years get to the point where they were able to develop a program that beat the world champion in Jeopardy. There are also at least two key differences between us and Watson. One is that we are much more interested in deeper semantics and inference, right? Watson was very shallow in what it actually understood about its domain. And secondly, Watson didn't publish, certainly not during the 3 years, and even after, if you've looked at the Watson papers, they leave a lot to be desired in terms of actual reporting about what algorithms did they use. Nothing was released as open source software. The papers that appeared in the IBM journal are less than satisfactory if you really try to, say, replicate what they did. So our model is much more open. We plan to publish as we go. We're actively seeking collaborations, and we're actively releasing things that we build in open source. So those are some key differences. Okay, let's talk about some of what we're doing concretely. One problem that we started to look at is arithmetic word problems. And what I like about these is that one of the claims about Watson was, gosh, maybe Google could do it, or maybe the answers to the Watson, to the Jeopardy problems are just, you know, the headings of Wikipedia pages. People familiar with these claims, right? Various cheap tricks could be done to do what was arguably an elaborate cheap trick. And that sounds way more pejorative than I intended it. Watson was a remarkable achievement in a number of ways, and less satisfactory in other ways. Anyway, what I liked about arithmetic problems, here, let's have an example here. So Liz has 9 blank kittens. She gave some of her kittens to Joan. Joan now has 11 kittens. Liz has 5 kittens left and 3 have spots. How many kittens did Joan get? Now, I'm going to conjecture that you're not going to get the answer to this question from Google. Okay, everything you need to know is in common sense knowledge, and in the problem setup. We do use multiple choice problems here, but I don't think that's a big deal. I would conjecture that if you have an adequate program to solve this, you don't need to see what the multiple choices are. Certainly, our program doesn't do that. Another really important thing to realize is that while this might be a training problem, the test problem could be about anything. It doesn't have to be about kittens. It could be about dogs. It could be about cars. I could be collecting rare coins. I could be assembling model aircraft. This is completely general template. I better have some way of understanding arbitrary verbs, at least to the level of how they affect the worlds and quantities of change, if I want to solve this. So some ideas like David McAllister's, where he was talking about going from text and coming up with very general formalisms, are essential in this context, and I challenge him to take them and apply it to this data. And by the way, all the data that I'm talking about here we make generally available, and if it's not yet on their website, just email me and I'll get it to you. So what's going on here from our point of view? Well, we think that this simple problem can be modeled simply with some states and state transitions. So in the original state, right, Liz has 9 kittens, and then what happens in the next state after the gift? giving event, we've got Liz, and we've got Joan, and the details don't matter except that this is really simple. You'd think, oh, okay, certainly after, I don't know, 50, 60 years of NLP research, surely we have a lot of programs that can handle these really simple problems. They're self-contained, there's no complex semantics, et cetera, right? Wrong. Okay, so we built one, and I'm sure other people can build better ones. But I challenge people to take the simple problems and solve them before we go to the more complicated ones. The approach that we took is we said that what's essential here is to understand the verb in the example and what the verb is doing. Is it an observation, like there were 28 bales of hay in the barn? Is it a transfer verb where, you know, Mike's dad borrowed 7 nickels from Mike? Is it a destruction event, you know, the rabbits ate some of the potatoes, et cetera, et cetera. And again, there are different ways to model that, but we need to know the verb categorization if we're going to solve the problem. And for these kinds of problems, it turns out you don't need to know a heck of a lot more. So with a simple formalism, which I won't bore you with because it's not particularly good, we were able to categorize verbs with 81% accuracy, and we're able to then solve 77% of the unseen test problems. These are real problems as written for fourth grade arithmetic tests. So obviously there's a lot of room to advance from this. Think of this as a baseline. 77% I don't think is adequate for simple problems of this sort, and we were just doing addition and subtraction. What about multiplication? What about going into logic problems? It's just a wonderful arena for research. And if you dig into it, you find it's not about arithmetic, right?
These equations here are completely trivial. It's all about simple semantic models of the verbs and what's happening to the state of the world. We also went to geometry, and the reason we picked geometry is it was clear that you can't just stick to language. So here we looked, our data set was 100 ninth grade problems in plane geometry. And a typical one is the one I have here. So in the diagram, we have AB intersects circle O, and AC equals 24, et cetera, et cetera. And next thing, we have a diagram. Most of these problems cannot be solved from either component alone. You need to have some level of understanding of the diagram, as well as some level of understanding of the text, and an alignment between them to solve the problem. So we started by looking at this alignment problem, and the first thing we realized is if we take this problem as given, what we're really given is a file with a set of pixels. So the first thing we need to do is actually recover circles and lines and intersections from this. And we said to ourselves, okay, but fortunately this is really easy because vision is this very active field. This is a trivial vision problem, right? Black and white, there's no occlusion, there's no 3D. There's many of the problems that vision people worry about don't occur here. And yet it turned out that actually standard vision methods did miserably on this problem because they're not optimized for such simple things. So let me show you what we did and what happened. So first of all, to be clear about what's the output that we need, we started by saying we need what we call diagram understanding, which means recovering the shapes and then connecting the different phrases in the text with the shapes. So for example, when we say
secant AB, we know that it's this line. And when we say circle O, we know that it's this circle. We ended up modeling this as an optimization problem that takes into account the coverage of the pixels, the ability to map this into a rather simple set of shapes, and the alignment with the text. And we realized that this was NP-hard problem, but it turns out the function is submodular, and we're able to come up with an approximation algorithm that's both fast and actually does extremely well in practice. So here, you can ignore the ablation study, just look at the light blue line and see that we're in the vicinity of 95% in F1 score. Our precision recall is very high. So we're able to do this really quite well. And I was going to show you a quick demo of this, but I was told not to touch the laptop because it might fail. So trust me, or look at the paper, which is coming out in AAAI, that we do much better than standard vision techniques. Next example, fourth grade science problems. And I say, quote unquote, common sense science, because as you look at these examples, you see that what's called science here is maybe different than quantum theory. So for example, what forces cause a bicycle to slow down when the brakes are used? All right, friction, electricity, gravity, or magnetism? Here's another example. Which example describes an organism taking in nutrients? A dog bearing a bone, a girl eating an apple, insect crawling on a leaf, or a boy planting tomatoes in the garden? So just to make sure people are awake and to give you a chance to stare at this, who knows what the right answer is? Please raise your hand if you know the right answer. Okay, yeah, this is a during this. Good. I just want to make sure people are awake. So there are lots of examples about this. Again, what I like about them is they invoke at least two important things. The first one is, I think you better understand the question, which I always like, so there's an NLP problem. And secondly, there's a lot of knowledge of objects in the world, common sense knowledge, hypernyms, synonyms, to be able to do this. So again, we're starting to ease our way into semantics. Now, to persuade you of this, let me show you what happens when you try to use as a baseline a more retrieval-based approach. Again, when you do this, there's always somebody who says, oh, no, I can do this with word matching, I can do this with information retrieval. Just like with Watson. So again, this is not a proof by any means, but let me just show you some of the results we got out of our baseline. And by the way, just to make sure that we weren't cheating, we had a contract with another group who really believed in this approach. They worked extensively, they did better and better things, but they kind of topped out at 66% accuracy. It seems very hard to do better than that using retrieval-based approaches. So here's what happened with retrieval-based approach. Again, a very shallow model. It chose D. And the reason for that is it found a sentence, right? Let me clarify a couple of things so you can understand this. We have access to what's called the Barron Study Guide, which is literally the text you give kids who are going to study for this test. So we have a set of sentences that are highly relevant to this. And secondly, what we do is we take the question and each of the answers and convert it into an assertive declaration, a hypothesis. So H sub D says a boy planting tomatoes in the garden is an example of an organism taking in nutrients, right? And so we can create from the question and the four multiple choices, we can create four hypotheses like these. We can try to do some kind of IR type of information retrieval type of process with the sentences in the Barron's Guide and see what we conclude. Some variant of that is what one would try. I suppose one could also try this on top of Google or some other thing. I don't think it would be that much more successful, but I could be wrong about that. Anyway, in this case, you can see that it kind of keyed off of plant and taking in and nutrients and decided that the answer was D, which is incorrect in this case. Here's another example that's even more fun. We asked fourth graders are planning a roller skate race, which service would be the best for this race? And obviously, you're meant to reason about the properties of the different surfaces to conclude that what the right answer is, which is blacktop. The retrieval system concluded gravel by misunderstanding the sense of the word grader, and by seeing that gravel happens to match directly something. So I hope I've persuaded you at least that not understanding these small problems at least has the potential for getting the answer radically wrong. And so the approach that we've taken is to say, look, first of all, you need a bunch of world knowledge. You need to know what are the properties of gravel and blacktops and grass and so on, and what's necessary for roller skating and so on. And again, if you're still not persuaded by that, let me remind you of the Winograd schemas that... that Winograd talked about in 1972 and Levesque spoke about more recently. So how many people have not seen this example? Okay, so let's look at it. The city councilman refused the demonstrators a permit because they feared violence. In this case, they is... It's late in the day. There's the councilman, right? If the councilman feared violence. However, if you just change the word fear to advocate and you say the councilman refused the demonstrators a permit because they advocated violence, the interpretation, right, the binding for day flips from councilman to the demonstrators, okay? Now, what's beautiful about here, this is we change one word, the answer changes, and the only way you can figure that out is by knowing something about councilmen and demonstrators and who's more likely to be engaged in violence and so on. Here's Levesque's example, one of his examples, which makes this point even better, I think. Large ball crashed right through the table because it was made of styrofoam. It here is the table. Right? But if I say the large ball crashed right through the table because it was made of steel, then it is clearly the ball. Right? So again, I need to know things about materials, their properties, furniture and their properties. I need some basic knowledge to solve this. And by the way, that's a huge emphasis for us. So in the workshop I've been in all day, a lot of discussion of semantics and issues around that. I believe that all those questions are important, but we're going to have a hard time if we don't have an adequate knowledge base for this task. And by the way, I don't have time for this in this talk. Let me just summarize it. One of the things I did recently is I took all these fancy systems, whether it's Nell or the OpenAI system or, you know, the Google Knowledge Graph or your favorite system, ConceptNet, that supposedly has a bunch of knowledge in it, and I checked how much does it know about a simple thing like an apple. The apple, the fruit. And I was shocked at how the most basic facts about apples, like they have an edible flesh, they have a peel, were not known by any of these systems. So we're operating these days with very knowledge poor systems, and we're tying ourselves in knots thinking about all kinds of fancy issues. I would conjecture that we should at least achieve some level of knowledge parity. Just have the basic facts in the system that the 10-year-old has access to if we want to have a shot at solving the problems. So one of the things we've done is done a fairly meticulous analysis of fourth grade science questions and what is it that you need to know to solve these problems. And these are roughly drawn to scale. So you need to know an enormous amount about language, paraphrases, various active passive transformations. You certainly need taxonomy. You better know what a squirrel is or that, you know, what a fruit is or that a girl is an organism to do this, et cetera, et cetera. You also need to know more sophisticated things like need to know about processes and right. Percy and Jonathan have some work on that. And a lot of these turn out to be very hard hard problems. Let me also show you some of the other problems that arise, and these are all data sets that we're happy to share with you if this sparks your intuitions. We looked at the problem of coreference that shows up in our test. First, we ran the Stanford coreference system, which is supposed to be state-of-the-art. Needless to say, while it may be state-of-the-art, it did completely dismally on our data. And I just picked out a few examples that are relatively non-trivial. We have plenty of pronouns, resolution, and the standard stuff, but again, some birds fly south before winter each year. This is an example of blah, 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 right? So what is this referring to here? A student has a ball of clay that sinks when placed in a pan of water. Which property should he change to make the clay float? So we better understand about properties, right, in order to answer questions like that. In fact, I would venture that if we had the requisite knowledge, this coreference problem becomes, you know, much, much easier, if not trivial. Last example, the diagram which I've omitted shows an electrical circuit. The purpose of the copper wire is blah, blah, blah. So again, here we have a reference to a diagram, like in the geometry case, except the diagrams are typically more complicated. So I think diagram understanding is pretty essential if we want to solve these kinds of tests, which we're very committed to. We also have a ton of entailment challenges. Let me show you some examples. So some of them are not unlike ones you've seen. I need to know that absorb is taken. And by the way I'm getting these entailment challenges is we've looked at the questions, we've looked at the corresponding statements in the text, and we realize that to get from one to the other, this transformation is necessary, not claimed to be sufficient. So I need to know that 24 hours is a day. So we have various kinds of synonymy. It gets harder in a hurry. We have questions that say, something like the answer is that candy is not healthy to eat for lunch. And in the textbook it says candy is not healthy to have for dinner, right? So we need to bridge that gap. If it's not healthy for lunch, it's not healthy for dinner either, and vice versa, to be able to solve these problems. So we need to realize that lunch and dinner are siblings in some particular sense. We need to go from blue eyes to the color of your eyes. I stopped labeling these because I'm not even sure what the transformations are. We need to go from disappear to evaporate, because when water evaporates, it disappears. Maybe evaporate is a means here. To go from cold to decrease in temperature. That's an interesting one because cold does not imply a decrease in temperature, right? Maybe cold, which I might define as 15 degrees centigrade, because I'm originally from Israel and that's pretty cold for me, that might have involved an increase in temperature from 10 degrees, right? So, very tricky transformations here that are absolutely necessary to solve our problems. So the current methodology we're engaged in, and I see that I'm running out of time, so I'll go fast. But we're engaged in a methodology that's very much about taking our training tests, identifying where we have gaps, figuring out scalable ways to inject the knowledge into the knowledge base, and then trying again. And the reason that the methods have to be scalable is because all we have access to is the training data. We have sets of test data that are sequestered that we don't get to look at, and we periodically run our systems and see how we do on them. But we don't know what the knowledge necessary is. So if we see squirrels in our training data, we conjecture, wow, they're asking about squirrels. They could ask really about any animal. I better know properties of any animal to be able to pass an unseen test. So we're having a lot of fun with this methodology. Now, I've emphasized knowledge, and then you might ask, well, so is this all about knowledge? Am I just saying, let's build knowledge bases and we're done? And the answer is no, by all means. Knowledge here is, again, necessary but not sufficient. Let me show you some of the semantic challenges that we've thought about. So we see sentences in the text, like fruit contains seeds. But again, for us, this is not some abstract conceptual challenge that could be resolved in any of a number of ways. This is a very concrete challenge in a system, right, that's taking several thousand sentences and trying to map it to knowledge that then we can reason over to answer questions. So this is very much in a particular context. And we see that the problem of interpreting this boils down to issues about quantifier scope and quantifier strength. Is it the case that all fruit contain a seed? That's false. Is it the case that most or many of the fruit contain a seed? And you can just wave your hand and say, oh, well, just associate a weight or a strength and a probability with that. That's not good enough for us because we need to decide what strength to associate if we're going to solve this problem, right? And what are the clues to that? Anyway, et cetera, et cetera. And we have some answers to this, but I feel like my answers are a lot less interesting than the question. Another issue is word sense ambiguity, which we're all very familiar with and shows up in our data in spades. And there have been a lot of work on word sense disambiguation or mapping words to ontology. There's a very active field of name-to-entity linking these days. The issue I have with these is that typically it requires anticipating the needed distinctions up front. Well, in our simple task, we've encountered things like that a person is an animal, that water is a basic need, that shiny crimson is a bright color. Okay, and these are just a few examples. I submit to you that it would have been very hard to build an ontology that a priori anticipates these classifications. And so the standard methods which build ontologies up front just wouldn't work on our data sets. So we're trying to develop a different approach. So let me summarize the approach that we're taking. But again, what I want to emphasize more than the approach that we're taking is the problem sets, the data sets, and the way in which they ground a lot of the discussions that I think, well, certainly in my workshop, and hopefully other people have been having. I'd love to see more people get engaged with our data sets to help drive the discussion forward that we've been having all day. So our approach is knowledge and tractable reasoning necessary for AI. We need to find a way to make that knowledge acquisition be highly automated. We're focused on acquiring these bodies of knowledge automatically from text, and then testing our behavior on these unseen standardized tests. And I should really omit multiple choice, because we're not, that's not an essential aspect of our system. We're not committed to multiple choice. We are committed to being in science, arithmetic, and geometry. Each of those invokes, right, different things. Geometry, the vision, and the diagrams, they're also in science. Arithmetic is a very natural way to get you actually focused on aspects of the language, and science often brings in large amounts of background knowledge that need to have, and semantic challenges are everywhere in what we're doing. The last thing I want to mention, and then I will open it up for heckling. I saw Martha taking some notes. Thank you for your patience. I'm going to start with you, if you don't mind. But I also want to mention that another project that we have, which in some sense is a more of an applied project, but in another sense it opens very similar fundamental questions. We realized that the kind of machinery that we're building on information extraction from text and developing better machinery for doing that could also be applied to literature search. Many of us use Google Scholar or some other search engine like that on a daily basis. And if you think about it, it's keyword search it's a keyword search engine with some sprinkling of metadata on top, like author names and maybe venues and years. I think we can do a lot better than that by trying to extract more semantic information from the citation graph, from these academic papers, even from the diagrams. If you think about, you say, the histograms or the graphs in a typical paper, we can interpret those a lot more easily than arbitrary visual scenes, and we could use that interpretation to make sense in part of what's being said in the paper. And so if I want systems that have improved on, I don't know, my system that was published in 1998, well, I could try to look for a program that looks at diagrams and figures and tables and tries to give me those rather than just keyword search. So we're investing in this project as well. Unlike the other one, right, the whole fourth grade science math thing, those are benchmark tasks that are meant to lead to algorithms or representations. This is actually an artifact, and again, I think would be darn useful if we're able to build it. And again, I have some visionary screenshots of what that looked like. Let me skip that and just conclude with the words, join us. That's the message of my talk. Thank you. Martha, please.
So, kind of two main questions. One is, so the work that CAP is to put conscience research at all relevant to what you're doing? Sorry, I was
I'll repeat the question. So is the work that Pat Hayes did on common sense reasoning, is this relevant in physics? Is this relevant to the work that, that we're doing? Absolutely. So I think that the whole history of work on common sense reasoning and NLP is relevant. It's been characterized by a dearth of working programs. And so I'm, you know, very clearly in the camp of, I'm from Missouri, show me. Yeah, relevant, you know, what open source directory can I download the, his code from and how does it do on our tests is the next question.
Okay, so then kind of following this. So there are a lot of resources available, and you've also talked about the inadequacies that we're met. And certainly what we're gonna give us is kind of one slice.
Yes, so first of all, I think obviously there's additional resources like BurbNet and PropBank and others that a lot of work has gone into. I do believe that those are valuable, and so we're looking at those closely. And I also believe that probably for them to have an impact here, they need to be extended, possibly automatically. The approach that we're taking in particular is very pragmatic. If anything is available or could be crowdsourced, let's use it. I think it's a fascinating exercise, for example, to take resources like that, to take these arithmetic tests, right, which are very much focused on verbs, and to see whether they can help. Now, in the case of the arithmetic work, we actually specifically looked at VerbNet, and we were not able to find the specific categorizations that we needed. That doesn't mean anything, and the learning approach we use, for example, could have leveraged what's in there. So I think the short answer is yes, and the long answer is yes and yes. Meaning, yes, those available resources, and yes, we need to build on them and extend them further to get to where we need to go. Right. So, well, I won't repeat the question because people can hear it. So, two points that I want to clarify. I spent the many years trying to automatically extract things from the web. The work that we're doing right now happens to be focused on more limited corpora, not just the Barron's Guide. We found other guys. We found simple Wikipedia. That's just a clarification about my own stuff.
Your access to textbooks as well.
A big word?
Do you have access to textbooks?
We do. We have a small number of textbooks that we're using as well, and those tend to be important. The question that you asked, though, very much stands and is very much a weakness, actually, of the paradigm that we've been employing. Because what we found empirically is that you're dead on, that a lot of the information that we need ain't there. For example, 24 hours is a day. Duh. But no self-respecting textbook for 10-year-olds is going to say that. So then the question becomes, this ancillary knowledge, where are we going to get it from? Is it from text or elsewhere? So great point, and that's a huge problem for us. So I'm not sure if I understood your question, but I won't let that stop me in the interest of time. There's a huge amount of knowledge that you need for all kinds of things, and some of it might be from embodied agents, some of it might be from all kinds of things. We're committed to a methodology where we identify the knowledge that we need based on these questions that come from the task, and then we go after in this pragmatic way, how can we get that knowledge? Is it from VerbNet? Is it from Vision? Is it what have you? And then we iterate again. That was the point of that slide that I kind of rushed through. So we are looking at gradually increasing concentric circles, and we found that there are plenty of things that we need to get without becoming too esoteric. So for example, paraphrase, for example, basic knowledge about apples. Tell me, and please don't say psych, where am I going to get basic knowledge about apples and squirrels? Okay. And if I can't get it from anywhere, I hold each and every one of you personally responsible. Yeah. Right. So I think the heart of the question is, if we use these relatively simplified tasks, and these certainly are simplified and arguably contrived, right? We've got these capsule summaries, and these are for fourth graders and so on and so on. A lot of issues about context are left out, these story problems, et cetera, et cetera. How do I know that this will scale in interesting ways, and I won't just be if I or you work on this with your graduate students, we won't just discover quote cheap tricks that don't scale and are ultimately uninteresting when it comes to the true problem of natural language understanding, right? That's the heart of your question, and I think that's a fair question. I think that's a question that one would ask of any methodology where you try to work gradually, right? So if I start with linear functions and quadratic functions and polynomials, people ask, oh, but what about this extremely esoteric, theta function, Ackermann's function, etc.? And so it rapidly becomes a question of are these meaningful subtasks? More than anything, it's an article of faith. So I don't have especially not kind of 4 months in to the project. I don't have strong evidence to that effect. What I can say is that I've been really happy that as we've looked into these data sets, they've led us to questions that were pretty broad. So for example, the approach that we happened to take, and maybe there's a different one in the arithmetic problem, was it led us to think about how do verbs change quantities of objects in the world, and what kind of verb categorization can we employ here. I think that's better than random things, and it certainly doesn't do justice to the full semantics of verbs. So I think the risk is there, and maybe my best response is to try and distract you from that risk and point out to the risk of what we're doing this morning, which is talking extensively about extremely complex examples, but without a framework or methodology to make concrete, empirical, measurable progress. Every methodology has its risks. I'm not at all suggesting this is the only one. I am suggesting that this is a worthwhile one to have in our portfolio. You looked like you were going to...
Yeah,
so again, just to make sure that I'm clear, absolutely agree with you, there is no one correct task and so on. Nor do I mean to say, you know, if I were a funding agency, would I say should 80% of the field, 100% of the field be focused on these data sets? That's crazy. I would be happy if 10% of the field was working on this. I think that would be great. When do we move on? How about when we solve these problems, right? And there's a very natural progression, which is once we've done the arithmetic, let's do multiplication. Once we've done multiplication story problems, what about logic story problems? Once we've done those, you know, science, and then once we've done those, you know, there's a very natural progression here, and we're very much at the infancy of it. But 10% would be great.
So first of all, thanks for a great talk. I've been intriguing examples. I like the science examples a lot. I'm a little more worried about the how much the math examples stretch for the reason that they are not designed to test people's knowledge about the world, but rather to simply make math problems a little bit more challenging for the kids. You know, at the core, they're math problems, which have been disguised a little bit to make sure that the kids understand how the math applies in relatively simple world situations that may not require much inference. So, you know, there are some standard kinds of problems that you can repeat over and over again with different numbers if you want it, and still get much of the benefit of having word problems in a way that wouldn't be possible with science problems. Is that a fair comment about the math problems? You've looked at them much more closely.
Yeah, so...
I'll give you an example, actually. One that's not like this because it stood out. So you know the Cushman et al. Paper from the ACL this year where they were solving algebra word problems. So they were able to do very well on quite a lot of problems, but then there were some, only a few, that required extra world knowledge, like you know, a particular painting is 4 feet by 3 feet, and the print has an area of such and such, how tall was the print? And you need to know that the aspect ratio is preserved. But they said things like that didn't happen very often, which is what leads me to believe that they test world knowledge much less, and inference much less than the science stuff.
In our work and in Cushman's work, and there are a number of people who've started working in these problems, we actually divide the problems into ones that require world knowledge and ones that don't. We explicitly do that, and we find that, as you predicted, we can do a lot better on the ones that don't. I would argue that even the ones that don't require world knowledge still require some pretty important understanding of the text, of the question. And I think that the approach, the supervised approach that Cushman et al. Took is actually quite brittle. It's very easy to see how you just give it, you know, somewhat different problems. For example, problems with irrelevant sentences, and their approach rapidly degrades. So I guess what I'm saying is I agree with your characterization of the problems and the issues, and I would just say that surprisingly, there's still plenty to do here. And again, to go back to maybe unify both comments, you know, I would rather that people didn't challenge me with putative cheap tricks. I'd rather they came up with the cheap tricks. They're cheap, should only take an afternoon or a week. And then once we solve those problems with cheap tricks, move on. The problem with putative cheap tricks is maybe they aren't there. That's all. I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
The necessity of world knowledge seems to be kind of critical. And I was wondering about resources for that and what sort of resources are what resources are allowed to use for attacks? Is it everything? Is it either a lot of these things that you were wondering about? At some point, people how many hours are in the day or whatever. And
you put a webcam in a kindergarten and just transcribe everything in the kindergarten or server here.
Yeah.
People are doing something.
They might not tell you that Neville has skill because they're getting that from sensory information.
That's actually the Wikipedia that Neville has.
Yeah.
The Wikipedia that
Neville has. It's actually in Wikipedia, like, I don't know that's Neville, but it's
So I'm not sure I understood the question, but let me respond to the more concrete one, and then I'm happy if you re-ask it in a more targeted form. The fact that Wikipedia states a key fact only helps me slightly. It helps me with sentence selection. The problem of extracting formal knowledge from Wikipedia is extremely hard, particularly because of the genre that's in Wikipedia. So when I said that that information was not available, I was talking about formal or even semi-formal resources. So it's not in DBpedia, for example. Can you ask your question again? I just didn't get it. I'm sorry. That's an issue, yes. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm wondering if your criticism of IR methods is fair, but all fair. So you took, sort of fairly simple word matching, and then the decision by frequency, right? In fact, IR has gone well beyond that, right? You say it's first indicated, latent semantic analysis of vector space, and to generate high dimensional matrices and performing linear algebra. It's come up with methods that can evaluate semantic relations to a much higher degree than methods. And these are tested against crowdsource judgments. So it might not solve the problem you had in mind, but it will solve other problems that are, for example, much more successful in word memory and practices. What world knowledge is implicit and sometimes made explicit in these methods. Now that you're using the multimodal system, you get image match text. So these methods seem to me to be not cheap at all. They're expensive, but they are kind of scalable methods that do give automatic procedures for learning a lot of what is clearly important components and ingredients of knowledge of the world. It doesn't require to sort of code and encyclopedia uses methods. I wonder if somehow these methods ought not to be discarded.
Yeah, let me clarify. When I was talking about IR methods, they were not simple at all. Again, there have been an extensive investigation of these kinds of methods, literally, several person years of work specifically around these alignments, and those additional refinements led to substantial improvements. They just seemed to have asymptoted. So first of all, it wasn't some simple, cheap baseline. Point number two, I was not including at all, latent semantic analysis of the text, and there's a whole, field of distributional semantics and so on under IR or cheap tricks. I think that those types of methods are very interesting ways of getting at certain kinds of semantic information. So where I was drawing the boundary was about things that attempt to align the words in sentences in extremely sophisticated ways, but without going to a representation that's not word-based.
So in particular, did the baseline use WordNet, and did it use any parsing?
The baseline did not use parsing, and the baseline did use some WordNet in some simple, very simple ways.
Did use.
Yes. Rich.
So it seems like a good point that you're making here is that knowledge acquisition is a big issue, sort of bottleneck for the problem. And I'm wondering what you think of as how difficult the inference problem is once you already have the knowledge. Is that something that will just sort of fall naturally out of acquiring the knowledge necessary, or is that
Let me answer the first part, because I already forgot the second one. Feel free to ask it again. I think that's a great question, and I tried to hint at an answer. I'm really not sure. You know, I'm sure of two things. One is that we need a lot of knowledge. Ed Feigenbaum said the same thing. A lot of people have. And B, that we haven't gotten it. And then C, right, that this kind of measurable methodology is really going to help us. As far as your question about knowledge and inference, what I was trying to suggest is that actually they're very intimately intertwined, right? So I might not know in some a priori way that water is a basic need. So I'm not suggesting some process that operates over, you know, billions of sentences and get some very large set of statements in a database, and then we're good. Now we need to do inference. I'm suggesting that it might be a lot more involved than that, where we might explore some knowledge base that we have in a using particular inferential strategies, given the question, for example, in a much more creative way. So, for example, I might only think of water as a basic need in the context of the question and the context of other knowledge I have. So I'm actually not making that separation the way I think your question was suggesting. Was there another part that I missed?
Well, the second part was, do you think so acquiring knowledge seems to be a big problem for answering the science test questions. And is the inference step, do you think, is that easier for the science test questions than in general? For example, if there are multiple choice questions,
right. So it's my very fervent hope that a bunch of problems are simplified in these contexts. It's actually been surprising and frustrating, actually, to some extent. So it's kind of the opposite of what Percy said. Percy said he was worried. Well, Percy had a worry that we'd go down some rat holes that were trivial. I would love things to be simplified. So, for example, I was hoping that we'd be able to read descriptions of processes, and processes were just these simple, discrete steps that were linked by, you know, causal connections. First you do A, that causes B, that causes C, and life is good. As it turns out, even these simple processes for fourth graders have overlapping steps. It's very difficult to tell causal connections from temporal connections, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So to me, I'm hoping for the kind of simplicity you're talking about. Often the problems turn out to be somewhat hard. The good news is they're not nearly as hard as they get in reasoning about arbitrary, you know, causal puzzles and arbitrary temporal connections, et cetera. And maybe we need to move to, I don't know, second grade science or something. Just one other question. you mentioned, right, that you were working in one of your projects, right, on recovering scripts, like restaurant scripts and so on. So you might have asked, well, gosh, how do you compare your kind of fourth grade science problems with the problems of learning a model of what happens when we eat at a restaurant? And frankly, I really don't know. I think that's actually very interesting to look at these different concrete examples. Really, the only advantage of my problem, and it's a pretty minor one, is it comes with a standardized test set that I don't control. But I know that other people, for example, have been looking at reading comprehension tests and seeing what happens when I give a little story and I give a little question that meant to test the reading comprehension. I think that stuff is great. I think learning the restaurant scripts is great. I think we need simplified problems. Yes?
Yeah, last question.
Yeah, so I have actually thought about that, and where I got into trouble is, so my thought was very much along the lines of what you said, which is, if I'm interested in modeling language, let me start with a kid who knows, you know, maybe a single word like dada or mama, and let me keep advancing, and let me see where we get stuck. And this was around the time where I had a baby, so it seemed perfect. I just kind of race my son and see who gets there faster. What happened is, as I was reading the literature, I found that even the linguistic behavior associated, or not the linguistic, the behavior, cognitive behavior, associated with learning a single word is remarkably sophisticated on the part of the child. It involves gaze following, it involves, you know, a lot of interaction, goal recognition on the part of the child. And so I realized that I was not able to build a system that exhibited the behavioral sophistication to operate over the same input than the child has. And for example, the thing that Jason said, people, I'm forgetting the guy's name, people have tried to record the full video input. I'm sorry?
Yeah,
thank you, Deb Roy, of the infant. And I was completely, intimidated, daunted by taking that input and trying to build something from that. So I've backed off to a problem that arguably is harder for the kid and hopefully easier for the machine. It would have made a lot of sense conceptually to start at the beginning, but it didn't work. Okay.
Well, let's thank Art again for our interesting talk.